welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM. And reminding you here on the way to this conversation that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com, and at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. We're going to switch gears and talk about what's happening in our community here in Baltimore. The election coming up, the murder rate, which is now one of the largest in the country. More people murdered in Baltimore than in New York City, a city of 8 million people. Robberies are up. The election is coming up. This can play a key role, but there are a lot of concomitant issues around that. And we want to hear your thoughts. So please do join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. And join or tweet us at Mark Steiner. And join Catalina Byrd, media consultant and political strategist, co-host of No Hooks for Hip Hop Chronicles here on WEAA 88.9 FM. Dave Onlove, director of research and public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, co-author of the Black Book, Reflections from the Baltimore Grassroots. And Doug Ward, director of the Division of Public Safety Leadership in the School of Education at the Johns Hopkins University and retired major in the Maryland State Police. Welcome. Good to have you all
Thanks
here.
Great to be here.
Before we do begin, I just want to do a couple of things here. And one of them is to remember Dr. Kiefer Mitchell, who passed away last week, whose memorial service was yesterday, who was one of our incredibly stalwart leaders in this community, who did a great deal for this for the community as a whole, who was a deeply beautiful man and somebody who people encouraged him all the time to move his office out of the West Side, inner city, as people say. He refused. He said, "This is where my service is. My service is to poor and working class people in Baltimore. This is where my office is going to be. These are the people I'm going to serve." His son, who I think in terms of being a highly ethical human being, is his namesake, Kiefer Mitchell. Our condolences go out to him and all of his family and all the Mitchells and all of Baltimore to have lost him. I also remember another woman, and I was quoted in her obituary this morning, Naomi Greenberg, who passed away, who was an amazing woman who died at 92 years old this last week. She was one of two sisters. Her sister, Amy Shubb, was one of Baltimore's great actors until she passed away at the age of 95. And they lived together in the end of their life for the last 15 years. And she was a person who fought for social justice before anybody thought about it in the 1940s, in terms of the white world anyway. And she was always in the middle of things and a great creative mind and a human being who lived life with exuberance and teach people like me how to live as we get older with life. And so I remember those two people who left our community this last week, and both meant a great deal. Okay. Chokes, do join us here at 410-319-8888. Let me begin here with just, you know, when you look at the issues in the papers that are coming up right now, and you see how the scrambles will run for office. We know that Sheila Dixon's running. Hope she'll be on the show, by the way, Wednesday morning at 10 to talk to us about her campaign and why she's running. There'll be other announcements, I think, that'll be tumbling out of the woodworks over the next few months. But the headlines of the last week, whether it was Marilyn Mosby now being attacked again and also charging a police officer for shooting a man they had in custody. It had to be a white man, by the way. He had in custody, shot him in the groin after he was handcuffed and held down by other officers. Whether you look at the murder rate, which is way beyond, has gone past where it was for a whole year last year, gone beyond the murders in New York City. The robbery rates are up. People are talking all over the city, whether it is in middle-class and upper-middle-class white neighborhoods or poor working-class and middle-class black neighborhoods in Baltimore, that the city's out of control. People feel it. It's palpable. So how do we – so that's going to be a big – that's going to have, I think, having a tremendous effect on selection and on what happens next. So talk a bit about why and what we think is happening here. Davon, you have not been on the show for at least 3 months, which is really a sin on my book, but you're back. So why don't you start?
Well, I think the analogy I like to use is that, you know, if you have, you know, a very muggy, humid environment and you have, you know, a lot of mosquitoes, if you're trying to get rid of the mosquitoes, I think some people would just try to kill the individual mosquitoes instead of taking the moisture out the air that reproduces them. And so I think in terms of the environment that we're in right now in Baltimore City, there are a lot of fundamental structural issues that reproduce then the crime, the robbery, the violence, et cetera. And unfortunately, you know, we are in a political context where, you know, there just hasn't been an emphasis on systemic foundational issues given the level of corporate support of many of the major candidates for office and those who represent, you know, the status quo. There's just so much resources invested in maintaining the fundamental structure as it exists, and so people are just tinkering around the edges. And my big disappointment just generally about a lot of the rhetoric I hear, you know, in terms of whether it's political candidates, whether it's people talking about change, people are just tinkering around the edges, you know, instead of really talking about fundamental social transformation that I think is necessary. Because the more we keep looking at short-term solutions to long-term problems, we're just going to exacerbate the issues we see.
Doug.
So I happen to agree with 100% with what you just said. But on the political side of the situation, it's going to be much more short-term issues. So one of the good things coming is winter. We're going to have cold weather, which is going to reduce some of the crime. I mean, I can track back 30 years, and the weather has as much to do with crime as anything else you can correlate. So although the fundamental issues are clearly the ones, that they're not the ones that politicians tend to try to tackle because they're too hard and they cost too much. So one of the what I think will affect the politics come the primary is what happens between now and then. And so one of the good things, I think, is you're going to see crime reduced just on its own some. So you can tout that that's a positive step going in the right direction. And that could be a major sales point to the incumbents.
Who forget about the weather, but say, I did something marvelous here. Kat?
Well, to quote the late, great Frank Conway Sr., I feel like this is going to continue to happen because we need jobs, jobs, jobs. When you
he did say that every time he ran into the
every
was
time
one
he
platform.
Ran for mayor, it was one platform. It was jobs, jobs, jobs. And as we watch, as the economy has come back nationally but has continued to decrease here in Baltimore, and the resources continue to get less and less and less and less, what I'm most disappointed about is all of the candidates are talking about ways to invest in children and public safety measures and tinkering around the edges, like Davon said, but they're not addressing how we bridge the wealth gap between our more affluent communities and the other communities that we've seen. And the other thing that I don't hear anyone talking about that has me very concerned is, what is the plan for the one-year anniversary of Freddie Gray's death to make sure that what happened in Ferguson a few weeks ago doesn't happen here in Baltimore? Because that'll be a week away from the election, and it'll be a very real and present thing.
It will be a week away from the election?
Right.
Okay, I didn't think about that at all.
Apparently they don't either, because I haven't heard anyone say, you know, and we had a lot of people that went from Baltimore to Ferguson, so who's to say that they won't come from Ferguson to here? And is anybody strategizing around that for the purposes of making sure that everybody is prepared and in a good emotional place and trained and not emoting recklessly?
Well, let's throw this a little more deeply in. Folks, please join us here, 410-319-8888. I know you're passionate about Trump. I know you're passionate about your city. And we want to hear your thoughts at 410-319-8888. You may have the solutions. We want to hear those solutions. And as we go there, I also have one person I neglect to remember, which fits right into what we're talking about. And Edith Fletcher passed away as well. And Edith was Anthony Anderson's mother. And she fought for justice for her son since he died in police custody, and was a fighter for social justice. And Tawanda wrote to me, to Jones, last week when she passed away. She was devastated by the death because we were very close. It was Tyrone West's sister. And these women have been leading that fight in Baltimore around this issue, and really has been the women out in the forefront here. I think that's really important to say, because the voices always tend to be male that we see thrown out in the media when the leadership has been mainly women. But I think these things are real. I mean, I think that people are feeling very unsafe in their communities and also feeling very unwanted or unnecessary. The front page of the Baltimore Sun this Sunday, there was a picture of a young man whose name is Tavon Wiggins on the west side. I don't know if you all saw that or not. But the article was about him and young men like him who can't get jobs. There are no jobs. And B, when they do go for a job, think they're going to get a job, they don't get the job because they have some minor arrest record, which was just meant nothing for trespassing or urinating or whatever that might be. during that period of mass arrest that was happening. So and that stuff is real, and we have to know, and yet we have to specifically address that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a part of the issue is that I think there isn't a broad level of fundamental understanding of what the issues that we're facing are. So if we look at, you know, communities in Baltimore, we look at many of the areas that have large concentrations of people of African descent. We're talking about, you know, black folks that typically, when you think about resources invested in their communities, the resources invested are beds for incarceration, right? We're talking about, you know, higher levels of patrol where there isn't really substantive community policing. You know, we're talking about investments that are made in ways that don't actually benefit and put power in the hands of the people in those communities. And I think a part of the issue that we're facing is that people just don't like to talk about the uncomfortable issue of institutional racism and how it organizes the social political life of this city in the ways that's really real. You look at all of the indicators of quality of life, you know, and every indices of the way that you would measure that, black people are at the bottom of that. And so, and the fundamental question is that, you know, when people have the power to determine the socioeconomic political dynamics of the institutions in their communities, right, then they're able to have more healthier, more prosperous lives. But the problem that we have is that we have a political climate where there are folks that profiteer, right, off of the suffering of people, right, where there's shadow agencies and quasi nonprofit organizations and certain government agencies that receive, you know, millions and millions of dollars to do things for the community instead of putting resources in the hands of people in their neighborhoods. You have the, you know, these professionals, the professionalization of, you know, helping poor black people or poor people in general. And I just think that we need to go beyond just the surface level rhetoric and really start talking about, you know, how do you increase the amount of social, economic, political power in the hands of those most directly affected by institutional racism and poverty in general.
And I think that when you look at that, there was a Harvard University report that came out. I don't have the exact date here, but we were talking about it the other day, and I'm pulling up and using it for programs coming up, that Baltimore was dead last in this country in the study for upward mobility for black people in the city, for poor black folks especially. Dead last. I mean, that's an issue that's at the heart of everything we're seeing around us. Mm-hmm. Unless we start talking about that and have mm-hmm. mayors who are running for office to address that, we'd do, as you say, tinkering around the edges and just playing the politics that you were talking about. Not what you said, but it becomes this kind of temporary solution politics as opposed to any kind of thinking about what to do to really deal with it.
Because the only way to get up a mobility is my proximity to particularly white-controlled-dominated institutions that have the resources to finance the things that I'm doing or to have the social networks to get certain opportunities. And so if I'm a person that's invested in my community, you know, we're talking about whether it's Lower Park Heights, whether we're talking about Edmonton Village or Sandtown, if I'm interested in upper mobility, I have to look outside of my community in order to get access to opportunities, resources to build up the things that would help to benefit me individually. And so the problem is we have solutions about helping individual people, but there aren't the conversations around solutions to build collective community, economic and social political power. That's the part that's missing. You hear people talking about, you know, we're going to improve housing or we're going to, you know, deal with unemployment. But unless you deal with the fact that many of us in our neighborhoods are just objects of larger political forces, well, we don't have any say in terms of how those institutions operate. You know, if you think about something like the Greater Baltimore Committee, right, they don't have people in Sandtown, Winchester, in their conversations about the economic plan for Baltimore. And if they do, they're hand-selected because of their relationships that they have with corporate interests. And so I just think it's important that – and I mean, it makes sense why people wouldn't say – it's not like I'm confused why people don't say these things. I mean, people's careers and livelihoods depend on their complicity, you know, in that. But until we start really forcing people to be clear about that, we're going to see the same problems.
And then we'll go to the phones here.
Well, that's definitely true, too. And then there's also the fact that when you look at it from the political angle, like Doug was saying, if they fixed it, then what would they run on? You know, that's kind of been one of the things that's always annoyed me when people talk about the blight in Baltimore, is that when you go look it up in the Department of Taxation records, most of it is either owned by the mayor's office and the city council or BDC, so which is still the mayor's office and the city council. So when we talk about these new ideas and what to do, if they wanted to fix it, they could have done it yesterday. They could have done it 5 years ago. We were talking about it in 2011 on your show when I was running. Like, they know they have to allow some. They have to allow some things to stay problems because it creates the platform on which they run. And if they without that, they would have to dig deeper and like find a real rhetoric and have to connect with real people. And I think that's part of how people have lost so much hope in the system. is that they've watched them for years tell them the same thing, and it has still gotten worse and worse and worse.
And I think we often look for short, quick fixes, and that's not going to work in this situation. And I've said this for years, and I'll keep saying it. This is a 20-year fix. So this was beyond four-year cycles of elections. This is a regional issue. It's not just a Baltimore City issue. We need a regional, grand strategic plan where, you know, there are a lot of really good, well-meaning people and organizations out there trying to do good work in the city. But it's not well-coordinated, and it's not all pointing in the same direction, and there's not priorities on which pieces get done first and second and third and how much goes here and there. It's not that it couldn't be done, and it can be done, but it's really difficult politically. But that's what we have to do as a region. We have to sit down with all the disciplines, and it's going to take 20 years to do it, and it's not going to be easy at all. But
it's
going
to take 20 years to accomplish, but if it doesn't start now,
absolutely,
it'll take even
absolutely
longer
there
than
are
that.
Pieces that could start tomorrow, and just coordinating what's going on a little better would help get more momentum out of it. And you know, like I said, there are a lot of well-meaning organizations and good, well-meaning people who want to do good things, but they need a little planning.
Let me get the phones out here rolling in. What do you folks think? 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@sanishred.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. And Kwame, in Randallstown on line one, you're on the air.
Hi.
Good morning.
I think you all – good morning. I'm sorry. Good morning. Love
That's all right.
Show. I
good
think
morning.
You guys raised some great points. I think there's validity in the 20-year approach, not approach, but solution being 20 years out, some validity there. There's a lot we can do now. I really have – I can agree with everything you guys are saying. I think just my two cents, we African-Americans as a whole, just like going to church, we're looking for Jesus to save us. Just like in the political system, we're looking for some mayor. We're looking for Barack Obama to save us. We are looking for someone to save us every day, all the day. If there's a time when we could just – if there's a way, we can come together and say, okay, this is rock bottom. The system isn't working for us. How can we fix this on our own? The Jewish community did it in terms of how they were able to come from the Holocaust and say, okay, we are at the bottom. Let's build ourselves up. Now, we make excuses for that to say, well, they had white skin. Yeah, they came, instead of being Smith and Steen, he changed his name to Smith. They blended in. They made their money. It really comes to the guy, Dr. Claude Anderson, in a series of videos that talk about how we need to build our economic power. You have the money. You control the courts. Control the business, you control the police department. Those things work in your favor. Black people, when we vote, we don't bring much to the table but our vote. I'm not saying we don't bring nothing. It doesn't sound like we have nothing to offer, but we do not use the power we have. There has to be a shift where we say, okay, this is rock bottom. Let's start fresh. We shouldn't have to go outside our community and ask any Casey or anybody else for money to help our community. We should say, you know what? Let's fix it ourselves. As men, I think the 300 men march is a step in the right direction, but it's hard doing it when it's once a week or once a month. It needs to be an everyday system. Something happens every day, and people need to change how we interact with our community. And we got to, I believe, music influences the world. And when we have music saying, kill this N, kill that B, and it's always talking negative, these are the positive rap that makes it off on a radio station. And Radio 1, a black-owned station, they are part of the problem because they perpetuate. They play this music all the time. And all it talks about is killing and hurting the community. So that's just my opinion. Again, I agree with a lot of things you guys are saying. My two cents is we got to change that. And just bottom out, say, this is where we are. Let's start fresh and work to do something different.
All right, Kwame, thanks so much. Let's wrestle for a minute with this. I'm going to throw something out here that Davon, you might disagree with. I'm going to throw it out anyway. because I think it's an important thing to think about and how we move ahead. I mean, I think it's also kind of a mistake to think that any group in America has moved ahead and gotten where it is completely and solely on the internal power of that group. Whether the group is black folks, whatever, Jews, whoever it might be, that has never happened. And in the Jewish community, it was true that when people first came over here, they were deemed as not white. But as Ta-Nehisi Coates said, when things happen in America, the bar of what it means to be white changes as historical moments push, right? And it has a lot to do with who gets the GI loans, who didn't get the GI loans in World War II. A lot to do with with
Homestead Act,
huh?
Homestead Act,
all that, right?
Yeah.
So all that was, but the idea that the solution can only come from within the black community for economic resources and more. What's the model to say that, how that works?
Yeah, I mean, I don't. Not to speak for, you know, the brother that just...
No,
you know,
I'm not... But, yeah, right.
But I don't think the appropriate way of thinking about it is, you know, exclusively black folks helping themselves as much as us developing an internal infrastructure in order to be able to solicit the kind of resources we need to be able to protect our interests. Mm-hmm. I think a part of the problem has been that there are folks that benefit from the lack of a substantial infrastructure to be built within the black community in order to be able to, you know, operate from our own interests. And so, you know, and it's important, just a little historical number. I mean, you think about, like, post-civil rights, you have black folks individually gaining access to certain levels of power and professional success who then represent those institutions. People get integrated into those major institutions, which then undermine the black institutions that existed in our own community. So you think about a lot of the black schools, a lot of the black civic organizations. You know, Howard McDougall in the book Black Baltimore, you know, talks about this notion of vernacular communities where the many of the functions that the government has served in order to, you know, right now that it serves right now in terms of helping poor people of African descent, those functions were operated by civic institutions, churches primarily, you know, people within the, you know, within particular neighborhoods and schools. And so you had an infrastructure that was developed for the purpose to help the entire community, because there wasn't really any choice, particularly for middle class, upper class black folks, in terms of their ability to navigate civil society. And so I think a part of what I hear in that message is the importance of developing an infrastructure, developing our own institutional capacity,
right.
So that as we solicit resources and help, it can be done from the basis of our interests and not being parroted from the vantage point of other interests that use black faces, I think, in this city to get people to buy into certain other people's agendas.
And, you know, and I think that, I mean, one of the things that I had dinner the other night with some folks, and I said that I don't think that we were in a very fancy restaurant having dinner. And not my style of place, but the food was good. It was just too trendy and too noisy. I don't like places with lots of noise in them. But we talked. It was right sitting in the middle of the Four Seasons Hotel, and we were talking in East Harbor, right? So, I said, this place we're sitting in, I mean, unless, and it has all the Patarakis and all the rebates he got for building this place, so as not to pay his taxes and everything else for 20 years, whatever that number is, I wouldn't care if he got that. If, on the other hand, he had to hire folks from neighborhoods right near here to learn how to be sushi chefs, to learn how to greet people at the door, to do the work inside the hotel. And that, you know what I'm saying? That there has to be a quid pro quo. If you want to get some money from the city to build, then you have to build something for the city that alleviates poverty and changes the nature mm-hmm. of what's destroying communities.
Mm-hmm. And
that has to be the equation.
And they're afraid to say that or do that. I think back to when Jack Young wanted to propose the bed tax, and everybody was like, oh no, if you charge Hopkins $1 a bed, they're going to up and leave. And I'm like, no, they're not.
Where else
are they going to get half a city for free? Where were they going?
And to that point, I mean, and here's the thing, I don't think people say publicly enough. There's a scramble for public dollars. There are people that are hustling off of their political relationship with public dollars to their own private financial matter. So you think about, you know, developers. So you think about, you know, like corporate interests. They make sure that they're able to get their bottom line, and that there's an entire process for that in terms of, like, how contracts are let. I mean, when you have the minority set-aside requirements that are often circumvented by special waivers, you know, you have people who are able to get these big tax breaks and without any terms or conditions. And what you have is you have financial experts who are trained in an intellectual academic discipline that teaches them that you need big business to be there in order to attract jobs. And so it creates this context where people are succumbed to this myth that, well, they'll leave, or, you know, they're not going to contribute to the city, and then economically, we'll, you know, we won't have. And see, that's the kind of mythology that supports the status quo that people need to be called into account. You know, and if you think about, you know, policies from the major institutions and figures in the city, they espouse that very philosophy that justifies the current economic configuration where we seem to be so dependent on other interests instead of building our own.
I think a very quick break. We'll come back and comment on this. And Linda, you're the next caller up. We're going to come right back to your call as soon as we come back from this very short break. And as we go to break, I read Ellison's tweet. Ellison tweeted from directed at Catalina, if short-term political solutions are an issue, curious about your perspective on term limits. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
WEAA remembers the life and legacy of Julian Bond.
We ought not be there. We ought to disengage ourselves, and that there will never be decent treatment for minority peoples in this country until we begin to concentrate on freedom and justice and equality for those at home and stop worrying about puppet dictatorships and despotic governments in Southeast Asia.
That's the voice of Julian Bond in 1967 when he spoke to television station KVOS about his opposition towards the Vietnam War. Throughout his lifetime, Bond wore many hats, serving as an activist and leader in the civil rights movement. He was also a politician, professor, and writer. In 1971, Bond was the first president of the Southern Poverty Law Center, and he served as chairman of the NAACP from 1998 to 2010. Radio talk show host Mark Steiner remembers Julian Bond.
He's going to be remembered as somebody, I think, who pulled the NAACP from the abyss, from the brink, and rebuilt it as an organization that, again, has meaning in this community. And that was, Julian did that. Three of the major civil rights groups in this country, he was at the formation of: the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Southern Poverty Law Center, and the NAACP. So he's at the heart of three of the most important groups in American history. And that's how he'll be remembered, as a civil rights thinker, leader, and warrior who is very affable and soft-spoken, but very clear and unequivocal. That's how we'll remember him.
President Barack Obama and many others remember Julian Bond as a hero and a friend. He will be missed by many, but his passion for equality will live on. Bond died on Saturday, August 15th, from complications of vascular disease. He was 75.
Remembering the life and legacy of Julian Bond on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here at 410-319-8888 on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And here with Catalina Byrd, Davon Love, and Doug Ward, and you. So call us or write to us at talkatsteinershow.org. Let's go to the phones, as I promised I would, immediately at 410-319-8888 to Linda on line three. Welcome.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Hi, Linda.
I guess I'm speaking as a visiting nurse in West Baltimore, and I met some really incredible people, and I learned a lot from the people that I saw. And one man in particular, well, there's two situations that I went into, and it really struck me, and it left a very positive feeling. But the first case was a man off of Poplar Grove, and he spoke of civic pride and personal responsibility, and his town row house was neat, it was clean, and he took pride in that area, in his house. And the area around it was dirty, not well kept, but that's what he felt he had to do. He felt like that was his responsibility to the community. And the other situation I ran into that I will never forget, it was this elderly lady that I saw for hypertension. He lived off of Mount Street, and the area was pretty much, most of the houses were boarded up. And she couldn't move out because she wasn't going to get the value of the house, and she was kind of stuck in the middle. But what inspired me the most was her grandson. She lived for her grandson, and he fortunately got a scholarship to Mount St. Joe. And while I was visiting her, and the drug trafficking is around Mount Street, he went through that neighborhood, and he, you know, you wear the khakis, the shirt, and the tie.
Right.
And he walked through that neighborhood, and I met him many times, and such a nice young gentleman. And he walked in, and he was so polite, so gracious. The light in her eyes was just absolutely beaming. She was so proud of him. But the admiration is that he went through that area, which was drug-ridden, you know, boarded up.
Right.
But he did it for his grandmother. And those two cases, I mean, I met a lot of inspirational people in that city, and I just feel that if they all just would just look at the positives as a group and try to do it one small segment at a time. I mean, you can make big changes doing small things. And, you know, and seeing what the positive and the value of all the people in there and trying to build up on that. And also educating, taking, you know, realizing that education is very, very important. Now, that grandmother, you know, his parents had, and she told me this, you know, they were killed due to drugs. And, you know, so he didn't have a, you know, very good upbringing in the beginning, but she believed that education was how he was going to get out of there. And it was just a really, I did home care for 8 years, and now I work in a city hospital in Baltimore. And I see it as it getting worse, the attitudes and you know, and I just think the city has so much to give and the people have so much to offer. And we just need to funnel that. We need to get that and get that going and have that spread through all the community and the people like the grandmother and the boy walking through Mount Street.
Right.
And just all that. So, that's my comment.
No, I appreciate the comment very much. I'm glad you called. And I thank so much for the stories you brought to us and the work you do. But, you know, I think that when you take a story like Linda just told, the problem sometimes with the way we look at these things in our world is that there is something I'm not saying this is what Linda said. I'm just saying when people look at this as saying that there's something exceptional about this young man and his grandmother. I don't think there's something exceptional about them but that quote-unquote exception could be the rule if we did things in a different way. And I don't think that takes a great deal to change if we do things in a different way.
Well,
maybe I'm being naive. But
a part of the limitation, I think, is our local media market, where there's certain images and representations of Black people that are more highly circulated than others. So it's like, oh wow, you know, here's a person in the neighborhood who actually cares about their neighborhood and, you know, does things in their community. That would only make sense if you were consuming images of us that made it seem like that's not the norm in our community. And I think that there needs to be more. I mean, that's why I appreciate, you know, shows like this and others that, you know, you're given the opportunity to see different iterations of our community so that people can know, just as you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of great things happening in Baltimore that people don't know about. And that if there was more emphasis put on that, then I think it would help improve the morale and make people feel more invested in the fact that there are people in the community doing good work.
So let me go back to the phones here. But you want to comment on what the caller asked you directly? The tweet asked you if you agree it's a 20-year plan. What do you think about term limits then?
I'm for term limits. It's not a 20-year plan in that you have to be in office. I don't think that's what Doug meant for 20 years to accomplish it. I think more so is that it takes starting now and putting yourself on a course and a trajectory that changes things overall over the course of the next 20 years, similar to what we've seen the president do with these last 7 in office. There are some things that are still yet to come that are going to be impacted from decisions he's made during his administration that somebody else will be president when we finally start to see those outcomes and those numbers. But I'm for term limits. I think one of the reasons that people get comfortable in not providing what they promised they would and not working so hard towards it is that they know that they can't be fired. They know that they won't be fired and that we will just say, you know what, I'd rather not vote than to vote for the person running against them or support somebody running against them. And that's how they stay there. But the other thing I don't think that I don't hear anybody talking about is just like, why don't we ever focus not just on the community as a resource and build an institution? We are killing local businesses time and time again here as well, which makes it difficult to be here and be an entrepreneur. It makes it difficult to be here and want to support economically to change some of these things as a citizen without running for office, because we give all kinds of money and tax breaks to outside companies to come in and build things. The Horseshoe Casino is having a negative impact on downtown and the people on the block. I know people might not think about them, but everybody survives some kind of way. And, you know, between the after hours and the things that happen on the block, which is an industry in and of itself, the casino having a 24-hour liquor license is impacting small businesses, just like it's also not making the profit it was supposed to, and the money's not coming back into the community the way we were promised. It has multiple layers of screwing up.
I want to get back to the phones here, but you want to comment on that at all, Doug?
No.
Okay, go back to the phones here. No. I just wanted to get more thoughts on that. 410-319-8888. Let's go to line four. Mike on line four.
Hello, Mark. Thanks for taking the call.
Hey, Mike. How are you?
Doing well. So I'm listening to this conversation, and I just wanted to bring in another perspective, because so far we're talking about Baltimore as if Baltimore was whole in itself. And Baltimore is really part of a much bigger picture. And there's an economic system that we're talking about. And I want to quote David Simon in kind of bringing up some of these issues of Baltimore. He, in a lecture at Loyola, once said that if you want to understand why Baltimore City schools are ignored, all you have to do is look at where folks are working, which is to say that we don't need to educate people in Baltimore City anymore because there are no jobs for which people need to be educated. The number one employer has gone from being Bethlehem Steel to being Johns Hopkins. The wages have plummeted. There are no particular skills that are necessary unless you're becoming a nurse or working in one of the higher skilled positions, but most of them are lower skilled, lower wage positions. And nationally, it's the case that GM is no longer number one employer, but instead Walmart is. If we were to focus exclusively on political solutions in Baltimore, I think that we would kind of miss the mark, because Baltimore City, in that kind of ecosystem of power, is really limited in what it can do. What's unfortunate, though, is that what politicians are doing in that context is going in the opposite direction of where we need to go. So I'd like to hear comments on kind of the broader picture of what's going on outside of Baltimore. And kind of as a footnote, just looking at what's going on with Larry Hogan in Baltimore. And Baltimore is in decline in power as a state. This was written up recently in the Washington Post, noting that in Hogan's map of infrastructural improvements for transportation in the state, he completely left Baltimore City out of the map and also out of that investment paradigm. So kind of what we need in a broader picture, broader perspective, if we're looking for solutions for Baltimore that require good leadership and stronger social movements within Baltimore, but kind of much broader systemic transformation, and how those interplays work out.
I think Mike, everything he says is kind of spot on about what we're facing. So
I kind of take issue with a little bit of it, because while we come in last for upward mobility for Black people, if you look at different things for certain industries, like in the tech sector, we are rated third for new job growth for people that do graphic design and IT and cybersecurity and things like that. So to say that notion has been that we don't educate them because they don't have jobs that they need education for. I know Kendrick Tillman and others have been trying to get support for STEM programs that would allow them to compete for these jobs that are coming right here in our own backyard, that are attracting the implants that are transplants that are moving here from other places, because you can get a job in Baltimore in a certain industry that starts at $75,000 a year and buy a house in Canton or Eagle Park and live a decent life. But we don't even create the opportunity for that access for our children at all.
So, I mean, and Doug, I think that's part of the 20-year plan you're talking about that has to happen.
Yes, and let's start with what we're talking about here is education. So if you have a health support system, prenatal care, and a decent education system, and all the science on education will show you that it's clear, children can learn. So children are able to learn. So there's no reason we can't produce our own high-tech employees, right? So the kids are able to learn if they were healthy, they've had a healthy existence, if they've gotten the opportunities to stay in one school. I mean, I can't tell you how many kids get tossed around 4, 5, 6 different schools in a year because can't keep the rent up, moved around. That's no environment that you can learn in. We have to fix those fundamentals, and they're tough, but that if we don't fix that, and then we need to bring in other jobs. Now, we talked about Hopkins jobs. Those are good jobs. I don't care what you say. Those are good jobs that come with good benefits. We need more of that. We need more industries brought into the city as part of this plan. Right?
But they need to pay taxes. One of the reasons that it's a double-edged sword, Hopkins, is we don't have enough landmass geographically to offset the revenue we don't bring in because of how much.
Does that mean churches should be taxed too?
Well, I'm okay with taxing churches too. We are too small. Mm. We're too small to have this much land that's given away for free. It then makes you outprice your market. Your few homeowners are paying too much in property taxes that can never offset the amount of land that is used. And in real estate, they always say, you know, land never depreciates because God isn't making any more. If Hopkins and Mass is a third of what is our geographic land mass, and the rest of it is owned by people who are paying the utmost property taxes but still receiving the poorest services in the city, their streets have potholes, and the other half is a renter's market that is beyond a normal median cost of living. It's a bad formula. It's just a bad formula.
Well, Doug, I would respond to that. Then we can go over to Dave Vine and back to the phones.
Well, I understand the arguments. I really do. But, I mean, you know, Hopkins employs 40,000 people. You know, except for the state of Maryland, it's the number one employer. And I think that does a lot for the city and does a lot for the state of Maryland. And I agree, you know, we can have this public policy argument about taxes and so forth, but I do think the net benefit is greater with the jobs and the upward mobility and the good quality jobs that it provides, not just Hopkins, but other institutions. It's not just about Hopkins. There's a lot of not-for-profit institutions that provide good quality jobs and services to the city.
To the gentleman's point, so when you talk about Baltimore, one of the things that I remember shocked me when I first learned about this is that, like, there, if you think about the General Assembly, there are elected officials and people that refer to Baltimore as a black hole. Right? Because they see it as all their money just goes to waste. It's full of dysfunction and pathology. And so that breeds two perspectives. One, which is we don't care about Baltimore. Investing in it is useless. Or the other, which is we need to fix Baltimore and make Baltimore better. The problem with those two polls is that it supports two different types of policies. One, which I think is representative of Hogan's policy of just, you know, forget Baltimore. Baltimore's not important. We'll build the future of Maryland without thinking about Baltimore as an anchor. The other is folks are going to come in and fix Baltimore, right? And the problem with that is that, so to Catalina's point about tech jobs being, you know, being in Baltimore, see, what you have is you have people that are coming into our city and aren't trying to build capacity of the people in the community to be able to get access to those markets or be able to create their own, you know, tech industries. It's about industries coming in and being able to take advantage of the resource of Baltimore, which isn't in and of itself bad. But the problem is we need to be thinking about a policy that isn't just about folding people into the larger economic currents of Maryland and Baltimore. We need a strategy that understands that if you don't invest in the community's ability to be its own economic engine, then we're going to continue to be dependent on outside industry in order to fix our problems in Baltimore. So it should be it's a mixed solution. You want to bring folks in Baltimore to help Baltimore get jobs and expertise, but it has to be done with in mind the importance of building so that places like Santa and Winchester can be a place where that's where tech folks come out of, because there are people in the community that have industry, that have, you know, expertise to be able to generate the kind of IT genius in order to be a resource for Baltimore. But right now it's not bidirectional. It's outside corporations and not the community building itself up.
And I think part of it is because the community development and economic development have been used interchangeably, like they're synonymous.
Right.
And so it's like whitewashing or painting a house, but you didn't really fix the structure. They'll
exactly.
go build some things and give you some vacant devalues in West Baltimore. But when a CDC in West Baltimore is trying to build, they have to borrow as much money to fix their own sidewalks and create sewage as they do to rehab the houses. Whereas in East Baltimore, the city is willing to cover and foot that bill for them and do all of the infrastructure things out of CDBG funds, so when the other community comes and asks for it, this says, oh, they're all gone now.
Mm-hmm.
But how is it that they always end up in the places where that have the political favor by the developers and builders that have the political favor? You can't ever figure out how to get it to the other side of town where they don't.
Like if Catalina and I started a CDC in, you know, Lower Park Heights, we wouldn't get the resources to determine how that community gets planned. It would be either some consultant or it would be a political patsy from the administration that's tied to those corporate forces that will then construct a plan that will benefit their business partners instead of people in the community to be able to determine what happens in their neighborhoods.
It just boils down in my mind back to where we need a better strategic approach. And the reason you have that is because it's less chance for any individual interest to change the greater plan when the bulk of the people have agreed this is what we're going to do, this is what makes more sense to do, where, when, and how, then one politician has a difficult time saying, well, I'm going to give it to my butt over here. So that's what I'm trying to argue is that until we get to a point where we can agree, what are we trying to do with Baltimore? What's the outcome? What's it going to look like in 20 years? I haven't heard that out of anybody. What do we want it to look like?
All depends on who you ask. Some exactly. of us want it to look like it did when we were kids.
But I'll bet you we could all come up with 10 or 15 things that we could all agree on from all of our perspectives. What would we want Baltimore to look like and be like and act like
right.
in 20 years? And those we could tackle.
Mm. The only caveat to that is that there are people who profit from that not happening. And I think it's important for people to call out the institutions that make money, resources, and maintain their political power by folks not coming together and establishing what those things would be.
Let me go to the phones here, and I guess my folks in here to join us at 410-319-8888, and see what they're thinking. Mohammed, you've been holding on for a while. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning, and thank you. I really appreciate that. The gentleman on the show, the African-American gentleman on the show, I was going to Washables, Pan Washables, and I just turned it on and I listened. And he's made a good point. He's telling the truth all the way until he gets to his final analysis. His final analysis is always to go to the government or someone and get some money. Right? What about us having our own commercial entities and building up our own financial chest to do our own financial things? This is what Marcus Garvey and Noble Drew Ali talk about. And we ignore them. They came with solutions from God for us. And we ignore them. Every time our people do not listen to their leaders, especially their God-sent leaders, they lose. We're setting ourselves up once again for failure. Thank you.
Thank you, Mohammed. Let's go to line four. Donna, you're on the air.
I can always a good show.
Thank you.
Your last guest who spoke about the institutions that have to be straightened out, I this summer volunteered in the Sandtown Winchester area, and as a graduate of Baltimore who studied socioeconomic communities and whatever, that gentleman hit it right on the button. If you use Sandtown Winchester and the community around it, it is a melting pot of poverty that was created by our institutions that was supposed to help these families and their children become a better generation. And it hurt me to have to go in this community, see the same thing, and then listen to the children, because the children will tell you exactly what's going on. They will tell you how they feel about the community when they would ask us, why are we poor? Why are we in this condition? Why can't we get food? Why don't we have enough food? I mean, it's really, really amazing to hear the kids want answers to why their conditions are in, why they're in the condition they're in, the poverty, the hunger, the drugs. They know that they can't get out of that condition unless they get good education. So they're not, so we really need to, like your last guest said, we got to attack these institutions, the Department of Social Service and all those departments that are supposed to have provided services that help the mothers and their children have been a total failure, because no community to be in that condition in 2015. And I wanted your guest to comment, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I mean, I think that we do. That's something unique about Baltimore, I think. Not unique, because Detroit's like that, other places like that too, but there are cities in this country like this that the poorest communities are just devastated. I mean, I don't think people who don't either walk through them, live in them, know people in them, who spend time there, don't really get it about how poor some of these neighborhoods are and how frustrated and alone and destitute people feel in this city. People just don't get it, I think.
I had an Uber driver a couple weeks ago from Severn, which is in Maryland still, who was literally fascinated. He was like, you can go one block over and be in a completely different way of living. And I said, yeah, that's most of Baltimore. But I mean, until he started driving Uber a few weeks ago, he had never seen anything like it. It just completely and totally blew his mind that literally you can go from $500,000 houses to a block away and you're in a Section 8 area. And it was unreal to him, and it's unfathomable to him. But the other side of it is, and I was thinking something that Doug said, just because somebody provides jobs doesn't mean that everybody who has those jobs lives here. And so we have been often sold the myth that there are certain institutions we can't talk about because they provide the most jobs. But we don't know that all of those employees live
here. Do you know the stats, Catalina?
Do I know the stats? I know most of the police departments seem to live in
Pennsylvania.
But
when you're talking about Hopkins, do we know that we're...
I mean, it's not just Hopkins. State employees, everybody doesn't necessarily live near where they work, which is why they still have those programs trying to get you to buy houses and be incentives. So if... Even though you're employing someone, and we're not saying the employment is bad, if those individuals don't live here and they don't own here and they don't rent here, they're not spending any money here and they're not creating any revenue.
The other side of that is that most of the jobs being created that people want from the city are in the county. And so is the county then going to say, okay, wait, if we push that issue and say you have to have transportation so that people can get to the jobs that are in Hunt Valley, get to the jobs that are in other parts in Harford County and get there, that they have a right to say, oh, we don't live here, so you can't work here?
No, they don't have a right to say that.
And I think the larger point is that when people say certain X amount of monies is allocated for certain things, people who are in poverty, I think we need to take a closer look at where that money actually goes.
Yes.
Because I think there have been, you know, at this point, billions of dollars poured into many of the neighborhoods that are the most blighted. And we have to ask ourselves the question, you know, we look at Park Heights, you know, all the money that's been poured into Park Heights, where's that money? You know, and I think when we start to look at that, I think to your caller's point, you'll find that there was an intentional effort to seize the money that was put into these communities for people's individual financial benefit. And until we start to look at that, then we're going to see the same cycle.
There's a caller called in and couldn't stay on the line. His name is Robert. He called in to say, asked this question, what is the Black Lives Matter movement doing about black-on-black crime we see in Baltimore? What's his question?
You would think that with all of the many different ways that the Black Lives Matter activists have explained this, and we have pontificated about it over and over and over and over again, that the separation of the two would at some point start to be clearer to other people. All violence is, we've already found that all violence is basically tribal. Black people kill black people, white people kill white people. It's about who you live around culturally and what your race is. And that is separate and apart from the issue of police brutality and the facts that black people are subject to on a more consistent basis undue death and or injury at the hands of law enforcement than any other race.
I just think he called
it's not rocket science.
But I think there are, the reason that question comes up, I think, is because there are a lot of people, especially in the black community, who go, what about the crime inside of us? Mm-hmm. What about the deaths that occur every day?
The question to
I mean, that's why the question comes up, I think.
See, the thing about that is the people that care about that, I think it's important to talk to, again, media and institutions that invest in programming. Because my thing is, if you care about that, then you invest in the programs for the people to try to fix it. But the problem is the people who try to fix it aren't put on the front page of the Baltimore Sun, you know, in many instances, or aren't on local cable network news to talk about all the work they're doing so they can get resources. Safe Street still has a hard time getting them resources that they need to do the work. So my thing is, we should care about all those things. But if you care about it, help advance the folks that are doing the work so that the work can get done, as opposed to pitting one people that are doing one kind of work against another people.
We have about a minute left, and we haven't heard in a few minutes from Doug. So, Doug, let me let you chime in here at the end, please.
Well, to me, the whole Black Lives Matter thing should be about this kind of institutional racism that we see. I mean, I'm sorry, but the incarceration system in our country in general, the stigmatizing people with arrest records, you know, it's hard enough to get a job to start with, and then we stigmatize people. You know, the money we put into schools in certain areas. I mean, we have, whether we like it or not, negatively affected a population in this country, and we continue to do it. And until we tackle that, and there are a lot of aspects to tackle, You know, and in the police world, we're tackling a lot of them right now. I mean, these things are front and center and should be, and there's a lot of soul searching needs to go on in a lot of police departments across this country. It's not just about Baltimore. We are not doing right by young black men.
And I want to thank the three of you so much for being here. It's been a great discussion. You guys were lively and brilliant, and it's important to have. And thank all the listeners for calling in today and helping add to that. Davon Love, director. I was going to make you the head of police safety leadership. That's not right. Davon Love, director of research on policy. Police of a beautiful struggle. Catalina Bird, co-host of No Hooks for the Hip Hop Chronicles here on WEAA. And Doug Ward, director of the Division of Public Safety Leadership in the School of Education at Johns Hopkins University. Thank the three of you so much. It's been great.
Thank you.
Thank you all for calling in and writing in and making the show what it is. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineers, Andrea Melton. Our interns are Manifa Wilson and Calvin Perry. Our assistant producer interning is Sienna Greaves. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cut. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show, share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org, or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM. The voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.